Hello, you're with Big Ideas here on ABC Radio National. Paul Barclay with you once again. Today we're off to Lismore in northern New South Wales to talk about sex. Sexual anxiety is not uncommon, but at some point it can become a diagnosed disorder. In women, it's called female sexual dysfunction, and it's a relatively new condition. A condition for which the race is now on, says investigative journalist Ray Moynihan, to find a new wonder pill. He says our fears and anxieties are being preyed on, the extent of the problem exaggerated, and a well-funded aggressive effort is underway to create and market a lucrative new drug. Sex, Lies and Pharmaceuticals is his provocatively titled new book, and it investigates the quest for the pink Viagra, as the drug's been called. Let me take you now to the Northern Rivers University Department of Rural Health and this presentation by Ray Moynihan to an audience that included health professionals and clinicians. And I should say, some of you may find the descriptive language about sex used in this presentation confronting.
Sex, Lies and Pharmaceuticals tells the story of the making of a modern blockbuster condition. In the way that those films that we see that tell the story of the making of a Hollywood blockbuster, this book really goes behind the scenes and tells the story of the making of a modern condition. But unlike the films that tell the story of the making of a blockbuster after that blockbuster's out, my book has got in before the blockbuster has really hit. I think there's a tsunami of marketing about to be unleashed around the world as soon as the first drug for female sexual dysfunction is approved in the US market. That hasn't happened yet, but I think it's imminent. There are many companies clamouring for that prize, and I think that as soon as that happens, we will all be hit by the most extraordinary tsunami of marketing. What the story is about corporate influence in medicine so out of control that the very definitions of conditions and diseases are now being influenced and affected. And why is that a problem? It's a problem because in this case, blurring the boundaries between common sexual difficulties and medical disorders will mean that ordinary healthy women start to think of their sex lives as somehow disordered or dysfunctional, and they will become interested or available or vulnerable to marketing that suggests that they should be taking drugs which may be ineffective, costly, and potentially very harmful. We've seen Viagra vying to be the sex drug for women. We've seen testosterone patches, and recently we saw an old antidepressant try to get up before the drug regulators in America as a potential sexual panacea for women. But the story's not all gloom and doom, because the book also charts civil society's resistance to this marketing, which has been led by a small group of feminists and academics and professionals and students by the name of The New View, co-founded by a university professor in New York called Leonor Tifa. And Leonor Tifa is a character in this book, and I think an incredibly important voice in this debate about these controversial new sexual disorders. And unlike myself, Leonor has quite a sense of humour, and when she gave a presentation a few years ago, she just won an award from her colleagues in the sex research community, and she gave a presentation, and the presentation was titled, "Not Tonight, Dear, the Dog Ate My Testosterone Patch." So firstly, I want to talk a little bit about what is this thing called female sexual dysfunction. Secondly, I want to walk through the evidence that suggests that the basic scientific building blocks of this new condition are being constructed by drug company employees along with senior researchers within the medical and health professions. Thirdly, I want to mention that this is part of a wider problem and that there are ways of fixing it. And then I hope to face a Spanish Inquisition from Paul and yourselves. And I can see some people in the front row with tomatoes. And when I invited tomatoes, I was thinking metaphorically. I wasn't imagining there would be physical tomatoes here. Just for those people at home listening, there are tomatoes here. So what is female sexual dysfunction? There is a technical definition in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, known as the DSM. There is a technical definition with four sub-disorders of arousal, desire, pain and orgasm. And these have been around for perhaps 20 or 30 years, but they are highly controversial because in a sense they've been written as if the dysfunction was within the individual woman. Whereas in fact, a lot of other people within the world of sex research argue that sexual problems are nothing if not complex and are nothing if not the result of a complex set of causes, cultural, historical, economic, social, and of course related to relationships. So this focus on the individual functioning of a woman is highly problematic and highly controversial. A little history here now, because this is not the first time that ordinary sexual experiences have been pathologised. We just need to go back 100 years or so, and homosexuality, masturbation, oral sex were the signs of disease and pathology. And bear in mind that it was only in the 1970s that homosexuality was finally removed from the pages of the DSM as a disorder. Unbelievable. And just to mention, I'm not sure what the sort of moral standards of the ABC are these days, but I do want to talk about the clitoris, if I can, and Freud, because I think there is a fascinating development when Freud comes along and starts to promulgate an idea that I think has cast a chill shadow over women's sexuality for at least a century. He talked about the way in which the clitoris was the key erotic zone in female children. But in order for a woman to become mature, she would transfer the site of her sexual pleasure from the clitoris to the vagina. And by the 1950s, this idea is still alive and kicking, and you have articles in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, suggesting that possibly 75% of women suffer from a psychiatric illness called frigidity, which was technically defined as the inability of a woman to have a vaginal orgasm. And I think then we move to the 70s and you have authors like Shea Height arguing that this is one of the common reasons for so much female discontent and disinterest in sex is because of this fundamental misunderstanding dating back to Freud and beyond. It's a fascinating history, and I think it's entirely necessary to bring those historical understandings to bear on this current attempt to medicalise common female sexual difficulties. Of course, everything changes in the 90s when Viagra hits the streets. Billions in sales are instantly generated. The drug industry and the sex research community, elements within them, want to find the sister condition to go with erectile dysfunction. And so what I want to talk about now are the basic building blocks of that condition and the way in which they have not only been sponsored by drug companies, but in many cases actively constructed. And I wrote about this first in 2003, and then I said that this condition was the freshest, clearest example of the corporate-sponsored creation of disease. But I actually think I wasn't quite right, because looking back now over the last 10 years, the industry hasn't just sponsored it, it's helped construct it. And I'm just going to tell you how now. The first thing is to get the definition right. And so at all the key meetings where this definition of FSD and the sub-disorders, the key scientific meetings where this is being debated from the late 90s onwards, are not only sponsored by the industry, industry representatives are active players on the floor of those conferences. Now, I know that none of you believe me, so I just want to read from a drug company executive who was active at that time. Her name was Darby Stevens. She was a clinical research manager at Vivas Pharmaceuticals, which was a Californian-based company that was developing a genital cream for women. And she was interviewed for a documentary back in the early 2000s, and this is what she said. I'm just reading from Sex, Lies and Pharmaceuticals. During her frank interview, Darby revealed that in the process of defining the disease, this is a quote, "We've been able to get thought leaders involved in female sexual dysfunction and really work closely with them to develop this disease entity so that it makes sense." She went on to say, "We're hoping to be able to expedite the process of drug development and of disease development." It's a beautiful quote, and it was given to Liz Kanner, who went on to make a film called Orgasm Inc., which is coming soon, and I highly recommend. And I really don't expect you or want you to believe me. That's why the book's reference section and notes section is almost longer than the book itself, the rest of the text in the book. Because if you're walking this minefield that I walk in terms of the sorts of things that I'm uncovering, you really can't get anything wrong. But again, I don't expect you to believe me. You can check them all in the references. So you've got the sort of disease definition locked in back in the early 2000s, although it keeps changing. It's very fluid and controversial and keeps changing. But you've got something of a structure happening there in the early 2000s. The next building block is to establish how widespread this is. And how do you do that? You do that with prevalence surveys. So we have the first big prevalence survey coming out in 1999, suggesting that 43% of women have FSD. Now, that finding comes from a paper published in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, arguably one of the most prestigious pillars of the medical establishment. The 43% figure has been widely discredited. That survey was not run by the industry. It was run independently of industry, though two of the authors on the paper were linked to industry. But through the 2000s, we see something new emerging. We see a series of prevalence surveys where the actual research team includes company employees. We see a big global survey come out in the early 2000s, finding incredibly high rates of sexual problems all over the world. This survey was done in almost 30 countries, 30,000 people. We discovered that not only did Pfizer fund it, not only was a Pfizer employee working on the research team, but according to the lead investigator on the study, the whole thing was a marketing effort orchestrated by Pfizer to gauge interest in different countries around the world. In 2006, a survey comes out suggesting that 1 in 10 postmenopausal women have HSDD, that's hypoactive sexual desire disorder. That survey was not only funded by Procter & Gamble, who were about to launch a testosterone patch for HSDD, but Procter & Gamble's staff worked on the team that produced the survey. The importance of these surveys is that they help to create a sense of unmet need, and that is critical these days in pharmaceutical marketing, the manufacturing of unmet need for therapy. 2008, another survey comes out. This time, 1 in 10 premenopausal women have HSDD. That finding based largely on the answers to one question in a survey questionnaire. Boehringer Ingelheim funded the survey. A company employee is one of the researchers on the survey. And all five people who were part of the research team had financial ties to that company. I'm sorry about all this detail, but as an investigative journalist, that's what excites me. And it's only in this detail that you can see the bigger picture. So we've got the definition, we've got the prevalence, and now the next step is the measurement tools. How do we measure whether someone has female sexual dysfunction? How do we diagnose them? Well, the best way is to have a questionnaire, because a lot of the physiological measures just don't seem to work. So we need questionnaires. So as successive companies come along to test their drug, those companies help construct the questionnaires that are used to assess their own products. Maybe I'm missing something here, but it seems to me to be an extraordinary situation where the same company will produce the measurement tool to assess whether its product is working well. But this process has been encouraged by the Food and Drug Administration in the United States. It's one example of the extraordinary entanglement between industry and the health professions. In 2000, the Female Sexual Function Index emerges. That's sponsored by Bayer and a company called Zonnegan. 2002, the Sexual Function Questionnaire emerges, sponsored by Pfizer. Half of the authors on the paper are describing the SFQ Pfizer employees. 2004, the profile of sexual function questionnaire emerges. Procter & Gamble employees part of the team. That questionnaire is used in the clinical trials of testosterone to help show that the testosterone patch has had a statistically significant benefit for women. When you drill in and you look at what the actual benefit was, independent people who do that argue that while there may be statistical significance, the clinical meaningfulness is highly questionable. And that's what the FDA said, not me. So my favourite diagnostic tool, though, is the Decreased Sexual Desire Screener. This is a little five-question tool that some of you, if you're GPs, may have already seen or may soon be seeing, because the intention of the people who made the tool is to roll it out across the world. And the people who made the tool, of course, included employees from Boehringer Ingelheim, the German company hoping to market its old antidepressant for women with the so-called disorder of low desire. And I like this screening tool so much because of what it said in the press release that announced its birth in the world. So if you don't mind, I'd like to read from a Boehringer press release. Again, I get excited by this kind of stuff, but here we're talking about this little tool. The tool is a little five-question tool. It starts off with things like, was there a time when you had a level of desire that was pleasurable to you? The second question, do you feel you've lost that desire? It goes on from there. The questions are in here. I just didn't have time to go into them, but we can certainly come back to that. I just want to read from the press release. A new, easy-to-use five-question diagnostic tool, the Decreased Sexual Desire Screener, enables clinicians who are not necessarily experts in female sexual dysfunction to diagnose the condition with high accuracy in a few minutes. So that's nothing if not efficient. So just to keep moving along, we've talked about the disease definition, the prevalence surveys, the diagnostic tools. One of the next steps is education. And many of you listening will already know that the pharmaceutical industry sponsors vast amounts of ongoing continuing medical education in this country and indeed in many countries around the world. Last time we checked, there was something like 30,000 so-called educational events every year in Australia alone, funded by drug companies. 10,000 of those took place in restaurants, hotels, resorts, function rooms, and some very good restaurants indeed. And if you don't believe me, just check the Medicines Australia website. But increasingly, education is not just targeted at health professionals, it's targeted at the general public. And we saw this earlier this year when Boehringer Ingelheim was bringing their antidepressant before the FDA for the condition called HSDD, hypoactive sexual desire disorder. So in the weeks and months leading up to that FDA decision, Boehringer threw a lot of money at trying to prepare the market for the launch of their drug. They enlisted global public relations companies to work with them. They had love-ins for sex experts, paid them to come along and hear about this. They funded a documentary about desire. And they hired a celebrity to help educate the American public about this disorder of low desire. Her name was Lisa Rinna. I can see some people in here don't know who Lisa Rinna is. She is a former Playboy model turned television celebrity in the United States, married to another famous celebrity in the United States. She was the person that Boehringer hired to help educate the American women about this disorder. And one of the key talking points in that campaign, which rolled out across American television, was that 1 in 10 women suffer from a little-known condition called HSDD, and that there is a huge unmet need to treat it. Sadly, for Boehringer, the FDA panel that assessed their drug in the middle of 2010 decided on the face of the evidence that it did not meet the pre-agreed outcome measures for efficacy, and there were serious side effects attached to it, and they unanimously rejected that drug. Just to sort of move towards a conclusion here, as I mentioned earlier, the book doesn't just talk about the marketing. The book doesn't portray all of us as the passive victims of pharmaceutical marketing. The book doesn't portray health professionals as malicious, deceptive, nefarious folk teaming up with drug company marketing executives in some kind of conspiracy. That's not the reality. The reality is much more complex. The influence of pharma is much more subtle and much more profound, as the book outlines. But the book also tells the story of the way in which that marketing is being exposed and challenged. And while the book is very much about this particular condition, female sexual dysfunction, and the sexual disorders that are part of that, the problem of the widening of the boundaries of illness is a much bigger problem than sex and happens across the board. That's something I've written about in Selling Sickness before. So just to finish off on a couple of quotes from others, because the work of the journalist really is just drawing on the best of what's around them. And so there's probably not an original idea in this book. And so one of the key sources here is Leonor Tiefer. I've talked about her before. She says that what we're seeing here is the manufacturing of new norms of high and constant desire, and that if people don't live up to those norms, there is something wrong with them. Maybe they have a disorder. Maybe they need a drug. She calls that a sinister and insidious process. Dr. Iona Heath, who's currently president of the Royal College of General Practitioners in the UK, a brilliant woman, a brilliant thinker, a brilliant doctor, made some very touching comments about my book, Sex, Lies and Pharmaceuticals. She said it was a brilliant dissection of the tragedy of greed preying on fear. This book offers the possibility of a different and less cruel future. Read, think and act. But the last word I want to give to Richard Eckersley, an Australian thinker and a very important voice, I think, in contemporary philosophical debate, a voice that's helping us understand who we are and where we're going. And Eckersley says, and I quote him in the book, that the goal of much modern marketing is not only to make people dissatisfied with what they have, but also with who they are. Thank you.
You're listening to Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and Ray Moynihan talking about his new book, Sex, Lies and Pharmaceuticals. Let me take you back to the University Department of Rural Health in Lismore and my questioning of Ray Moynihan that followed his presentation.
Let's start with this condition, female sexual dysfunction. Do you rule out the possibility that it may exist as a medical condition?
No, not at all. I think that from the work that I've done, and bear in mind I'm a journalist writing about this, no medical background, not a sex researcher or a sex expert. From my reading, it's my sense that there is a cohort of women for whom sexual difficulties are so debilitating that a medical condition, a label, may be utterly appropriate and beneficial, and that therapy of whatever form, including possible medication, should they arise, could be extremely valuable. Mm. The debate, the question, the controversy is about whether that's a small and severe problem or whether it's a widespread epidemic, as we're soon to be told it is.
It's where you draw the line, essentially, between the normal problems that normal functioning human beings have with their sex lives, the fact that their kids keep them up late at night, that they're stressed out by working too hard. Everybody at some stage in their life, I'm assuming, has a less than perfect sex life, and those people who have what may be defined as a clinical condition.
That's exactly right, and that line, unfortunately, is moving all the time. Mm. And if you look systematically across the different disorders, the different diseases, the different conditions where we spend a huge amount of our health budget, you will find that those lines are widening all the time. And I think that who draws those lines, the processes for how those lines between the normal and the abnormal are drawn, needs a lot more attention.
And obviously what you're saying is that the pharmaceutical industry is exploiting that anxiety. But what's the root of the anxiety itself. Where's it coming from?
Yes, and I'm disappointed you asked me that, Paul, because I can't answer it, and maybe some people here can answer that later, and maybe the listeners all have their own answers, because I think there's a lot of common sense, actually. You know, the common sense is quite valuable. A lot of us already know why we suffer from sexual difficulties, as you outlined before. But the other thing to say is that trying to get to the root of these things can also be very complex and difficult, and they are questions for others. They're questions for historians, for feminists, for sexologists, and for clinicians, and for philosophers, and artists, and playwrights.
And psychoanalysts, who, of course, have been plundering this field for over a century. Look, you've been, as you say, a critic, really, of the pharmaceutical industry for some years now, and you're suggesting that really what's happening here is that they're attempting to shape, even invent, a condition so that they can then invent a drug to cure that condition and make potentially quite a lot of money out of it. It implies that it's relatively easy to convince women that they need a drug to deal with this condition. Is it that easy?
No, I don't think it is that easy. And I think that two things. I don't think drug companies invent diseases. I don't think they invent disorders. I think that they, what I'm arguing in this book is that they're helping to construct the building blocks of the science. And they are always doing that in concert, in alliance, in collaboration with people within the sex research community. Your second point is, no, I think a lot of women are extremely sceptical about the suggestion that the complexity of their sexual difficulties can be reduced to the simplicity of a drug solution. And as the book explains, we have seen a backlash before a drug has even been approved in the United States. We have seen a backlash emerge, driven largely by feminist scholars, but others as well, a global network trying to not only expose the role of the drug industry, but to offer an alternative explanation for why there is this sexual discontent, for why so many women have sexual problems and difficulties, for why so many relationships are fraught with problems about desire and other things. And so, no, I don't think it's going to be an easy sell. And the other thing that we've seen is that the drug companies, as so far in the United States at least, haven't been able to convince the regulators that their products work.
How long do you think that will take?
Well, that's a great question, and I mean, in the early 2000s, I was reading reports, intelligence reports by business analysts, suggesting that the market for a potential drug could be $1 billion a year. Mm. So there is huge interest on the part of pharma. They haven't given up. They have run into a huge problem in this problem of the placebo effect.
Yes.
The dummy pill. We could talk about that now or later, but I mean,
I was going to talk about that, and what you're suggesting there is that the initial results of one of the first drugs was in fact no better than the taking of a placebo.
Well, that was Viagra, really. Viagra was one of the first ones being tested in women in the late 1990s, early 2000s. The initial enthusiasm was that Viagra did work for women. There were some early papers came out in the scientific literature. They were not actually controlled trials, and so they really had quite limited value. When the randomised controlled trials kicked in, what they showed was that the difference between the placebo or dummy pill and Viagra was negligible, was almost identical. The results were almost identical. But, of course, Viagra carried some important side effects. Mm. And so Pfizer pulled out of the race, pulled its drug Viagra out of the race before it even went to the regulators.
This is the mystery of the placebo effect, actually, isn't it? That people who took what they thought was a drug that was working, it felt like it was working to them, actually wasn't working at all because they were not taking a drug, they were taking a sugar pill.
And this happened again with the testosterone patch in the mid-2000s. It's happened again with the antidepressant called flibanserin that's just come up before the drug regulators in the United States. The placebo effect has been significant. But to be clear here, that the placebo effect has been quite modest as well, and the drug effect has been modest and quite similar.
So what What is on the horizon in terms of these new drugs? What do they contain, and how is it envisaged that they will work on women specifically?
Well, there's several in the pipeline, and I don't think we have time to go into all of them, but there are some that affect the brain chemistry. There are some, I think testosterone is still, there are still hopes alive for testosterone on the part of some companies, and so I know that there are testosterone products in the pipeline coming up quite soon, in fact, and potentially there would be drugs that work in the same way as Viagra. I think there's probably some companies that still have hopes that engorging the genitals in the way that we see Viagra do with men could have some benefit. But interestingly, there's one interesting thing I've noticed. I've been going to conferences about this stuff for years now, seminars, conferences, reading everything there is to read, and it's interesting, when a drug solution's around, I think that affects the way the disorder is described. And so when Viagra first came out, there was a lot of attention given to the fact that female sexual problems could be an engorgement insufficiency, because the drug helped engorgement. And then when testosterone was looking like a possible winner, the problems were described as a hormone deficiency. It could be fixed with the hormone. Mm. And now, of course, as an old antidepressant gets wheeled in as a potential panacea, we see that all the emphasis is on the brain, and women may have some sort of chemical problem in their brain that needs fixing with an old antidepressant. Mm. So as my co-author, Dr. Barbara Mintzes, has observed, there is this awkward feeling that the disorder is kind of framed or portrayed in a way to fit the drug solution on offer.
Yeah. If it is the case that these drugs are dubious in their benefit or potential benefit, why can't we have faith that the drug regulators will knock them out and so they won't even make it to the market?
Well, look, that's a great question, and so far, as I say, the regulators in the US and Australia haven't approved any drug, to my knowledge. Testosterone was approved in Europe in the mid-2000s for a limited cohort of women, but after its approval, it was assessed by a number of independent bodies, medical bodies, other bodies across Europe, and universally it was trashed. It was condemned. Its benefits were so modest or negligible, and its side effects so serious, potentially including possible risks, increased risks of heart disease and cancer, not to mention the other sort of mild effects of testosterone in women, hair growth, effects on voice, enlargement of genitals and so on. So yes, there is some faith that we should have in our regulators, our drug regulators, of course. But it's important to note in that regard that largely the drug regulators are funded by industry as well. Mm. And the influence of industry on the wider medical profession is one thing, but it is the case that our drug regulators, through the user pay system, are funded to a large degree by industry. That's the case in Australia, certainly the case in the United States. And there are vigorous debates in the United States as we speak about whether it's appropriate for the world's most prestigious drug regulator to be relying on drug company money to operate. And there are whistleblowers inside the FDA very concerned about that. And indeed, there is legislation before the US Congress to try and bring the regulator back into the public fold, so to speak, and have it funded by taxpayer money. But that's another issue for another day.
Well, this brings us to the role of the clinicians and the GPs. In order for this strategy of the pharmaceutical companies to work, it will depend on the GPs prescribing these drugs once they are approved and on the market. Tell us a bit about the relationship between the pharmaceutical companies and how this could potentially influence a diagnosis of FSD by a general practitioner.
Well, notwithstanding the fact that there are large numbers of incredibly hardworking, compassionate, dedicated health professionals, some of whom are in this audience, many of whom are in this audience, many of whom will be listening at home, notwithstanding that fact, there is another fact and that is that there are 30,000 events sponsored by drug companies every year that GPs attend in their thousands. And you can argue that many of those events are produced independent of the sponsors, but I think that argument is looking increasingly frail. If we want our GPs to act without being influenced unnecessarily by pharma, we have to make some changes, either in terms of self-regulation or regulation, because there is no doubt that there is far too much influence over the way not just GPs practice. But having said that, I think there's also a growing and very interesting awareness among GPs, among the medical profession at large, that this relationship with the drug companies, the long boozy affair, is going to end. It's got to end. A new relationship is being negotiated, renegotiated before our eyes in all the medical journals around the world. It's a very exciting time. I think a clean-up is coming.
Yeah, the argument, I suppose, is that it's the pharmaceutical companies that have the money to invest to find the drugs of tomorrow, and providing you have proper accountability mechanisms, providing you have regulators that work, that you have peer review processes that work, you have seminars around the world where respected clinicians and researchers get to give their view, then there's nothing wrong with that. It's nothing wrong with them making money out of something that they invest in, and if the regulators give the drug and the tick of approval, then everyone's a winner.
That is the argument, and let me say that pharmaceuticals, medicines, prescription drugs are extremely valuable. They save lives, they extend lives, they ameliorate suffering all over the world. This is not a question about the importance of drugs. They are critically important parts of the healthcare system. The question is about whether the drug companies should be paying for our lunch. You know, it's as simple as that. Who pays for the pizza? And I don't quite understand why doctors or any particular element of the medical world can't pay for their own lunch.
Has it done something more than that? Has it, in a sense, influenced how doctors see the practice of medicine and how they see the desires of their patients? So someone who walks into a doctor's surgery, and I have friends who are doctors, and they say the pressure on them is enormous to give the patient something that they perceive will improve their condition.
Absolutely right. And in this sort of complex story about what influences doctors' prescribing practice, there are a whole range of factors. The drug company influence is just one. It is one. Patient demand is another. In the US and other jurisdictions, the threat of legal action is another. All of the doctors' training and professional acumen is another. There are many factors that influence, but it just strikes me that some of that egregious pharma influence could be wound back with the strokes of a few pens. It may take a few years, but we are going in that direction. The Sunshine Act was just passed in the United States. That will mandate that every single payment from a drug company to a physician over $10 will have to be disclosed on a public website so that patients, for the first time, can find out which restaurant their doctors had lunch at.
And
who paid the bill.
As you said in your talk, Ray, there are a lot of people not taking this lying down, if you'll excuse the pun, female sexual dysfunction and the seeming inevitability that the market will be flooded with drugs that the pharmaceutical companies will aggressively market and make lots of money out of. There is, as you say, the New View campaign. I'd like to know a bit more about the New View campaign and what's going on there.
Look, it's a small group set up 10 years ago by Dr. Leonor Tiefer and others. They came up with a kind of a definition of women's sexual problems, and they called it a much more a sort of woman-centred view, and they came up with a whole range of causes, cultural, economic, social, relationship. They have a kind of a manifesto, or it's a whole approach, if you will. But part of what they also do is expose a lot of the marketing activities. And so they have a listserv. I think it's a fairly small, modest group. They now have some continuing medical education products of their own that they use. They have a sort of a network around the world that talks to each other and tries to understand what's going on. They talk to media a lot. They have, for a very small group, they've managed to offer alternative and countering views to the views that are promoted by the drug company-funded thought leaders and so on. And they've been very successful in that. So they're widely quoted in respected media around the world. And it's my sense that a lot of different conditions within medicine could benefit from having ginger groups within civil society who take a bit more of an interest in how the business of medicine is happening. And I also think that one of the sort of key reforms here that I'm going to write about more in the coming months in the British Medical Journal is a move to establish new ways of drawing that line between the normal and the abnormal. The panels of so-called experts that do that, I'm sorry, they need to be closed down because they are too conflicted. They are grossly conflicted, and we could talk about condition after condition, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, type 2 diabetes, osteoporosis, whatever you want to talk about. We need new ways of defining who should be a patient and who shouldn't, because sooner or later all of us will be patients.
And can I just follow up on that and ask you, Ray, what the response from the pharmaceutical companies has been to your book? Will they debate you, for example, on...
Deafening silence. Deafening silence, the sort of silence I've never heard before.
Investigative journalist Ray Moynihan speaking with me at the Northern Rivers University Department of Rural Health in Lismore. You're tuned to Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and online at abc.net.au/rn/bigideas. Just enough time now for some brief comments and questions from the doctors in attendance.
Thank you. Leslie Barclay. I'm fascinated by the economics underneath this, and I know Ray and I have had some conversations about that already, but there's something else that should be stopping this, and that's evidence. And in medicine and science, we talk about evidence as a mantra that guides our behaviour, that guides our diagnosis, that guides our treatment. Where's evidence in this? We're creating the evidence post hoc for something that someone wants to do rather than saying we've got a massive problem here because we've got the evidence that this is causing us a problem. My own field in maternity care, caesarean section rates in Australia should be around 12 to 15% absolute maximum. They're sitting 30, 40, 50%. If you're privately insured in a private hospital, 50% if you're a normal, healthy woman. The consequences of this, as far as evidence goes, are astronomical. The economic consequences are astronomical. Who's stopping it? This is your power of corporate medicine and self-interest is far bigger than the mantra of evidence guiding our behaviour or economics guiding decision-making. So, you know, the two things that we might think are useful are not playing out.
There's some big issues you raised there. But let's say that in defence of evidence and in defence of the focus on evidence, one of the positive developments, correct me if I'm wrong, in the last 15 or 20 years has been a growing awareness of the importance of good evidence and the movement to try and make decisions more informed by evidence, I think has had some very positive aspects to it. The downside in the research that I do, the downside is that a lot of the evidence is being produced by industry and a lot of the clinical trials are produced by industry as well.
Ellen McGurr from Lismore. I've been in clinical practice for a long time and see a lot of women in middle age. That's the nature of my practice. And I dispute your comment that the problem doesn't exist. It may not be a disease, but there is a problem, and a lot of women talk about it, that they haven't got the same interest in sex and they're worried about it and they wonder what they can do about it. And I've had comments such as, I bet nobody will make a female Viagra. You know, they won't do that for women, they'll do it for men. Almost angry that nothing's available for women, so that's one sort of argument. And then the other sort of comment is when they hear about the testosterone patch or whatever and that something might be on the horizon, they say, bring it on. So there may not be a disease, but there is a problem. And perhaps part of your concern is that you realise that and you're worried that if there is something available, it'll hit the billions because there will be so many women that will want to take it. And I think it ties in with not just pharmaceuticals, but the whole society. Everyone wants to be younger. Everyone wants to be sexier. Mm. And so if somebody can come up with a product that sells that, everyone will want to buy it, you know?
Well, two things there. A, I'm not sure everyone will, but B, I've never disputed that there's a problem. I mean, I think that the research I've done has shown that sexual difficulties, sexual problems are common and sometimes disabling, as you have found in your clinical practice. And as you say, it's a question of whether we portray them or frame them as the symptoms of a condition or we conceive of them in other ways. And I think that it's an incredibly helpful comment. Thank you.
Could I just ask if to make a comment? You've laid a lot of blame on the pharmaceutical companies, and I can see why, but don't you think it fits into a much bigger societal problem? All the images, you know, movies, TV, fashion, is that men and women, we've all got to stay young and we've all got to stay sexy. And nobody wants to be old and past it. But that's the reality. Now, you know, you're blaming the pharmaceutical companies, but what about all the other influences that are on people and therefore shaping this whole
absolutely gender? Absolutely. And the book makes very clear that this debate about whether or not we're dealing with sexual difficulties or sexual dysfunctions is happening against a backdrop of a hyper-sexualised culture, where the sexualisation of young girls is a major controversy, where internet porn is available to young boys at the click of a mouse, where pornography has entered the mainstream of advertising and culture. And that's nothing to do with pharmaceutical companies, as you rightly say. But others will argue, as they do in the book, that pharma is set to exploit some of the vulnerabilities that culture may create and sell products that may be ineffective or harmful or unnecessary.
I just wanted to sort of make a comment, which is also from a clinician's point of view, that I think that part of the reason that the buying public's primed for this is that women coming in to see me with sexual difficulties may well be primed by relatively low health literacy. For a big percentage of those women, it might be the first time they've had a conversation about their sexuality, and they might be in their 50s. Also by low consumer awareness. So I don't think that in our schools we're equipping universally our young people with critical thinking to see through marketing. And we're a very marketing-prone society, and I think that this is one of the places where it plays out the clearest, that you know, people don't necessarily imagine. It's fantastic to have a voice to say that marketing is having an impact on health, but it's really hard to wind that back in the one-on-one situation, particularly if there's something out there that people have been told is good and that you're the one person between them and obtaining that.
This is what's fascinating. The minute we start to talk about a sex drug for women, there's an assumption that it somehow it works and it works brilliantly. And that's what I don't sort of get, because, I mean, I've read so many studies and so much evidence that shows so many drugs have such marginal impacts, you know, potentially, and side effects. And so far, as I said, there's been attempts to get approval, but the evidence just suggests these things aren't working. And so I think that's one key message that would be appropriate to distribute more widely, that just because a drug is there doesn't necessarily mean it's going to have the benefits that are imputed to it. But your question is, how do we sort of ratchet up the level of scepticism? I don't know. Debates and conversations like this one.
Ray Moynihan, author of Sex, Lies and Pharmaceuticals. Details of the book available at our website. Thanks to the Northern Rivers University Department of Rural Health and Director Professor Leslie Barclay. No relation.